This is the Disruptive Technologies panel. I'm Narayan Desai. I'm pleased to be moderating a distinguished panel of commentators. I guess this is like a PBS show. Basically, our idea for this event is to talk about things that are going to be changing the ways that we make large-scale and small-scale systems work over the 3 to 5 year term. So I think right now is a really interesting time in computing. We see, after a relatively long time where commodity hardware has kind of dominated the computing landscape, we're seeing all sorts of interesting new hardware innovation and software innovation. We're seeing a huge flood of data. We're seeing devices everywhere that produce and consume large quantities of data, fast networks, very agile systems, large-scale and small-scale clouds, the entire world being driven by APIs. And so it's clear that we're in the middle of a pretty large transition, and it's, I think, very unclear where we're going. So that's kind of the topic for this panel. We're going to go around, and everyone can introduce themselves, talk about the basic area that they're working in, and then each of them can sort of speculate a little bit about where we think we're going and what the big trends are, and what we can expect to see over the next several years. We're going to start with a discussion, and then we'll start taking questions after a little bit, once we sort of get things going. So Adam, you want to start?
Sure. Can I do slides? Or?
Sure. If you want to do slides, you can do slides.
I made 5 slides.
Somebody came prepared. He's just trying to make the rest of us look bad.
After the slides, I have a multimedia presentation. Involves an interpretive dance of the future of system administration.
Don't joke about that. That has happened.
Oh my!
Douglas, they do nothing.
All right, so I guess I should introduce myself first. So I'm Adam Olliner. I'm sort of a lifelong academic. Right now, I'm a postdoc in the AMP lab at UC Berkeley. I'm also in the process of founding a company called Kuro Labs, which is based on some technology that we developed there and that I talked about yesterday. So this is just a few slides on sort of the perspective that I have and to some extent the perspective that the AMP lab has on how system administration is likely to change in what I sort of refer to as the era of clouds and big data, and this is something that the AMP lab focuses a lot on. A lot of the stuff that we do is related to dealing with very large clusters, cloud computing, and big data computations. Right, so of course I'm you know, predicting the future here, and so I just want to give you a sense of how I go about trying to make predictions about the future, and the first step is to predict something that is already true but not widely known or is becoming true and is sort of guaranteed to happen, and this is pretty effective as far as prognostication, and of course there's no step two. You don't really need to do anything else other than make your predictions follow this recipe. So that's what I'm going to do. So this is more or less how my perspective of how I see system administration happening today. You have different systems, which are these shapes down on the bottom, so you have different resources that you're trying to manage, and each of them have some API that you can program to, and sometimes the individual resources will have their own APIs, sometimes the collection of resources will have an API, and so on. And essentially what you end up doing is you write scripts, and I use scripts to just mean programs that you are going to use a few times or run in your own system and don't have a lot of transferability between other systems. And it may be possible to share with someone who's using a similar setup as you, but for someone who's using a very different kind of system, there's no opportunity to kind of share these scripts. And of course, in the era of the cloud, increasingly the APIs that people are programming to become common. So the script that you use, you can share with someone else, and so on. And so what this means, when you have a common API that a lot of people are programming to, it becomes no longer scripting, and it becomes software development. So increasingly, what I see happening is that people are doing more software development rather than writing sort of one-off scripts and home-rolled solutions, and so on. And then, of course, we also have big data, which is the other sort of element of this equation. And so one of the opportunities that you have when everyone is working on the same kinds of systems is you can collect information about how everyone else is managing their systems, how those systems are running, and so on, and use that to inform the way that you develop your software and the way that you manage your systems. So rather than, for example, coming up with some new setup and saying, hey, how am I going to configure this so that I get the best performance or so that I spend the least money on my cloud resources and so on, you can simply use the big data that people have collected over time and look at what the answer is. So rather than sort of managing by anecdote, you can actually have the data to back it up. So post-disruption, I see the sort of following things. So first of all, less scripting and more software development. I think system administration will become a branch of software development, software engineering. Second, rather than managing by anecdote, so hey, how should I configure this? Or you know, what's the best way to migrate from X to Y and so on? Rather than just looking on a forum or talking with a friend or something like that, you can ask computational questions about what is the optimal way to do these things. You can actually solve optimization problems for these sorts of management questions. The cloud increasingly become a strategic advantage. So if you're not programming on the same common API as everyone else, then you're going to have to roll your own solutions. And at some point, there's a critical mass where if you're not using the same API as everyone else, then you have a severe disadvantage. Because there are solutions that other people have come up with that you'll be wasting your time re-rolling. And so, as I've said before, I think more and more administration will become a sort of branch of software engineering. Okay, that's all I wanted to say.
All right, I need that mic.
Or I can yell.
Hi, all right. So I'm Theo Schlossnagel. I'm the founder of OmniTI. We're a consulting company that helps people navigate incredibly large systems with large consumer bases, managing systems and networks and applications in every continent and lots of data centers over tens of thousands of machines. Now I'm going to change all what I said, listening to what you said, and rebut you a little bit, I think. So I think that predicting the future is pretty easy, because if you look at today, we're still stuck with the systems from 10 years ago. So I can guarantee you that everything you're running today, you'll be running 10 years from now. I think the question is what happens that's new and different. I think that that's already been set in motion, so it's not going to be very surprising. But as systems administrators, one of our jobs is to make software run reliably on unreliable systems, right? And if you look in the past, all of our unreliable systems have been remarkably reliable compared to the proposition of the cloud today. So now our job is to make unreliable systems work better, but the cloud is horribly, horribly unreliable. And today's software doesn't accommodate that. And today's software engineers, largely are not smart enough to build software to run in an environment that's effectively Byzantine most of the time. But that will change. So we will start to see software produced that can really run effectively in large scale, incredibly unreliable clouds. And 10 years from now, you will be stuck managing highly distributed systems that are quite fragile, and all of the software you manage today, which doesn't work that way, that needs to be run on unreliable systems. So I think that the challenges of how to run stuff in the cloud is going to be the focus over the next 5 to 10 years. And it'll be very, very difficult because you can't change a lot of the software you run today. I think that the sharing of scripts is something that's really interesting. As you all use the same API and you start to all use the same systems and you start to all share everything, you adopt everyone else's really horrible bad decisions. Big data is a great example of the adoption of Hadoop to solve every problem. Is a great example of that, where Hadoop's not a bad technology at all, but so many times I see somebody trying to put a drywall screw in with a sledgehammer, and the sledgehammer is Hadoop, right? It's really a poor application of that. But because it's everybody else's API and their scripts, I want to accomplish a goal, I see a script, I can avoid doing the work, I download it, I run it, I have got it. It fosters this idea of reusing tools that are not quite appropriate for the job. And one of the fascinating things about ops people in general is that as much evolution as we've had over the last 20 years in our field, people are still rolling their own stuff, right? every time Chef, a lot of the stuff that you talked about up there was very interesting. It's the pitch of Chef and the pitch of Puppet. It's the idea of, like, you know, writing these one-off scripts has got to end. We need to share this stuff. We've got these recipes. We've got these cookbooks. We can redo this stuff. We use Chef, and we have to rewrite every freaking recipe we've got because we are a snowflake like everyone else, and I don't want to adopt people's bad decisions. So I think that aspect of it will manifest itself very differently, exactly the same, right? We are going to be in the same position where we're pulling all this stuff in and still rewriting and still changing and still modifying and still innovating all of this stuff.
Hi, my name is Vish Ishaya. I work primarily on OpenStack, almost full-time in the community. I work for a company called Nebula, which is trying to take OpenStack and put it on a hardware appliance, which is pretty interesting. I think that predicting the future is very difficult. And I read an article recently that talked about how bad we as humans have been about predicting the future, especially when you get over about a 10-year horizon. So you get up to about 50 years and you look at the future and you say, oh, we're going to have flying cars, and they never show up. And then the internet pops up and nobody expected it. And the author of the article made a really interesting point, which is the best way to predict the future is actually look at what you have now and figure out which things are going to disappear. Don't look for new things, but look for things that are going to go away. Look for things that are going to get simpler. Like your phone. We still have phones that we had 100 years ago, but now they're a lot more convenient. Now they can do a heck of a lot more. And so you take technologies that exist and make them simpler, make them less obtrusive, make them more prevalent, and go that way. So I think when we're looking at what's going to be disruptive, we should actually be looking for things that we're not going to be doing in 10 years. And the in the particular cloud space that I work in, I feel like there are some steps that are going to happen to get us to a point where there's going to be a lot less going on in cloud. And what I mean by that is right now we've had sort of an explosion of different APIs. We've had an explosion of different technologies. I live in San Francisco, and go to any startup and they've got their own stack of 12 different technologies that they're using them. Some of them are remote services. Some of them they're written in four different languages. To be a software developer today, you have to actually understand four different fields or more that usually would be managed by, in traditional software development, by actually different people. You know, you have to be a database administrator. You have to understand how to write a web service. You have to understand how to optimize a distributed system. There's so much going on in order to create anything right now that it's actually almost impossible to do any of those things well, because it's just such a broad field of knowledge. And I feel like we're at a place where we're in sort of the initial stages of new technology, where compare it to when microprocessors first came out. Everybody was writing everything in assembly language. You had to get really into the guts. You had to understand all the inner workings of things, and had to write everything piece by piece. It was very slow. And then eventually what evolved is a high-level language. C came out, and, well, that's not even high level yet, but C came out, made everybody's life a little bit easier, and it became kind of a standard. You know, initially there were, you know, if you were doing systems engineering, you'd have 10 different languages you might try and write in. All these Lisp came out, and Pascal, there's all these different versions. A bunch of people wrote in BASIC, I don't know why. And then sort of it coalesced into a common framework that everybody used. And cloud hasn't really started doing that yet. We're still building new different technologies instead of coalescing onto some really powerful ones. And I think the simplicity and the ease comes in development and to the point where we actually can start pulling things away when we start coalescing. And it's interesting to watch the organic growth of new things being built and new technologies coming out, new languages being written, and then slowly they die out, and eventually we'll get to a point where things will simplify. At least that's my hope. So I'm looking for the things that are going to be going away over the next 10 or 15 years.
Okay, that wasn't working too well either. So I'm Jeff Darcy. I'm an architect on the GlusterFS project at Red Hat. Everybody always seems to ask, so I'll explain that I was actually at Red Hat before we acquired Gluster, which kind of makes me a little bit of the oddball on the project. So I'm going to look at things a little bit from a storage perspective. I'm a storage guy from way too long ago. There's a couple of trends that I think are really going to impact people a lot with respect to storage. At the high capacity end of the spectrum, there's a whole bunch of new technologies that we're not quite sure which ones are going to predominate. We've got heat-assisted pattern media, shingled disks, things like that, that are going to increase the need for people to be aware of different classes of storage, placing data on different classes of storage, and optimizing and tiering across them. At the high-speed end, we have a whole bunch of technologies, all of which promise to displace flash and totally mess up our lives. You've got phase change, you've got spin torque, you've got memristors, all these sorts of things. And they're actually, in most cases, more memory-like than disk-like in just about every regard other than permanence, that they are permanent, unlike memory, but their performance characteristics and their access methods are a little bit more like memory than like disk. And so people are going to actually use them a little bit more like memory or in ways that we haven't even really figured out yet. And this has implications well beyond the obvious, well, instant on is going to be really instant. It has things like security implications, is that if you have passwords stored in memory, I mean, yes, you already know you should be scrubbing them. The technologies for recovering data from memory after a power outage is still, it's been known for years. It's going to become even more important to keep anything even remotely sensitive a little bit more secure, even when it's in this memory-like technology. The other trend that I think it's a little less obvious how it relates to data, but it's the proliferation of devices that everybody has and uses. I check email and Twitter and everything else on 5 different devices on a regular basis. I switch between them minute to minute sometimes. I'm sure a lot of other people in the room are kind of like that. Now, if it's email, it's actually going to work pretty well because we have things like IMAP. And that keeps track of state of what I've read. So I move to a new device, I don't see all my old mail again. Most Twitter clients aren't that smart. I go to a new device that I haven't used for a few hours and I have to scroll through all the crap that I already read. A lot of other applications are similar. They haven't grown that intelligence yet. So there's going to be more of a need to have data kept in sync between devices or to push the services into the cloud, and then it becomes the cloud provider's problem to keep the data in sync. That's what my talk yesterday was about. Because now they need to be responsible for making sure that they have a geographic presence everywhere that your users are going, and that means that they need to be keeping the data in sync on behalf of the user. So either way, you have the same problem. It's just whether it's an application problem or an infrastructure problem. And a lot of the technology for that has been forgotten. Some more hasn't been invented yet. And I think over the next few years, a lot of people are going to have to look at this both from the infrastructure point of view and from the interface point of view to figure out how on earth are we going to keep from driving our users insane with this inconsistent behavior every time they switch from one device to another.
So I'm going to start with a couple of questions, but as people have questions they'd like to ask the panel, they can walk up to the mics and then we'll fit them in. So one of the trends that was sort of interesting, so first we can say that no one on this panel has met each other before and there was no coordination beforehand, but we saw some clear trends here. So there's a great quote about how computer scientists believe that you can solve any problem with another layer of abstraction, right? And everybody's talking about building that next layer of abstraction. And so abstractions are a great way to get simplicity, but the thing that happens at the same time is that it produces a barrier, right? So an abstraction barrier, I knew I could count on you, Andrew. So an abstraction barrier also obscures some of the things that are going on behind it. And so I think that what we're going to end up seeing are systems, and this is in some sense the explanation for what Theo was talking about in terms of a distinct lack of reliability in cloud platforms compared to dedicated hardware platforms. As you build an abstraction barrier, the things behind the abstraction barrier become obscured and you can't really tell what's going on. And so what used to be white boxes, or mainly white boxes, have become black boxes. And so we're building larger and larger systems that are composed of small or large black boxes. I saw a study recently that some researchers were doing on cloud computing, and it was structured like a physics experiment.
they were sending a workload at Amazon and they were measuring the results of Amazon like it was a natural system, right? It's not a software system, it's a black box, right? And I think that this is the kind of approach that is going to need to happen if you can't tackle systems in an analytical fashion. And so what's the right way to sort of calibrate?
I'm definitely going to knock over that water at some point. Just to, I guess, respond to that and also a little bit to what Theo said, I mean, the only time it's really right to build an abstraction layer like that is when what's underneath is stable in some sense, both in terms of the functionality that it provides and the reliability that it has in providing that functionality. I think today it's definitely not the case that the major cloud computing platforms have reached that stable point. I mean, I agree with that. But I also think that they're going to get there, and that when they do, there's going to be a severe advantage to those who are programming over that API. You mentioned that you still have a sort of snowflake system, and I think that's increasingly going to become less common. I think most people do not require snowflake systems, and that once the cloud becomes something that's reliable, it will be the sort of thing like when someone says, oh, you know, I had this problem I wanted to solve, and so I wrote my own programming language to solve it. And most people here, hopefully, would roll their eyes and be like, you almost certainly don't have to make your own programming language to solve this problem. You probably just don't understand the solutions that are available. And I think that will increasingly become the case, where if you're building your own cluster, that will be the sort of thing where people will roll their eyes and be like, it's really unlikely that that was the right way to solve your problem. And also, I just you were, you know, I guess, saying that you were rebutting something that I said by pointing to Hadoop and saying that lots of people abuse Hadoop. And I would just say that any API could be abused. It doesn't mean that it's not providing a valuable service.
I definitely think APIs provide a valuable service, definitely. Won't disagree with that. I think that, now I'm drawing a blank. Confuse me. Abstractions, yes. Abstractions. So I think what's really critically important is the abstraction layer versus the abstraction barrier, because you used those two terms. Everyone here has used hard disks. That's a wonderful example of an abstraction barrier, where things may look stable underneath, but they don't work. So I don't know how many people here have been screwed by disk firmware, but I would imagine 100% of you at some point have been screwed by disk firmware. And that's because there's an abstraction barrier instead of an abstraction layer. And I think abstraction layers are incredibly useful. But I think maybe it's drawing the line in the sand where operations versus software engineering go. And you're saying that they're converging. And that may be the case. But I think that when you start programming to an API, you're programming, you're a software engineer. Operations are the people that realize that those APIs are broken and the abstraction layers don't work, and they have to dive through them. And you can dive through layers, you can't dive through barriers. So the operations of the future are the software engineers are running these scripts to do large-scale systems configuration, and of course they don't work because software is shit from top to bottom, right? So you dive in and you're the person who fixes it. And there are bugs on every single layer. All the memristor, that's going to be fascinating technology. When you have hierarchical storage inside the bus, right? I mean, it's going to be crazy, and there will be abstraction layers there, and they won't work, and we will have problems, and that's what our jobs are—is to go through those layers and solve those problems.
Are you saying that we're abstraction janitors?
Abstraction penetrators. Janitors. It'll work.
Is that good? Do you guys want to?
Yeah, I think that actually is a really important point that you can always solve a problem by adding a layer of abstraction, and you can always create a problem by adding a layer of abstraction. The other thing that Theo said that really resonates with me is every time there's a new technology, there's new failure modes, and they tend to get weirder every time. Disks fail in certain characteristic ways. Actually, they used to fail in one set of characteristic ways, and modern disks can fail in a whole new set of characteristic ways. Disk arrays and disk controllers can fail in different ways. Flash can fail in a whole different set of ways. They have different pathologies, they have different symptoms, different patterns of data destruction. And so every time we see new technologies, and just specifically in my area, you know, one of my reactions is, oh, great. Now I'm going to have to add a whole bunch of code to recognize when it fails and how it failed and what it destroyed in the process. And that's something that I think probably everybody in this room is going to be very sensitive to over the next few years as these storage technologies come online, is that you're going to have endlessly new and creative ways to lose your data.
Andrew Hume from AT&T. As a sort of a comment, particularly to Mr. Olinda's thesis that everyone's going to have to become a programmer, God help us now. We don't, our programmers can't deal with the programming problem very well. And you're going to make ops people do it as well. This seems like a recipe for disaster, particularly as distributed programming is the hardest programming we don't yet know how to do, right? I mean, we routinely fail at this all the time, even with professionals who do this for a living. So your point may in fact be true, but it's surely the death knell of something, perhaps our industry, but it's the death knell of something. One thing I wanted to do though, because we're talking about disruptive technologies, I thought I would lob some what I think of the disruptive technologies or some disruptive technologies that, and see what your comments are. The things that occur to me are in fact memristors. You know, we surely don't know whether they're going to be real or not, but the thought that we might have multiple terabytes of memory inside the chip that might be preloaded and so forth strikes me as extraordinarily disruptive. We're working on systems where we expect to get 100 gigabits per second wireless networking. You know, that's really going to change things. That's faster than a PCI bus. You know, it really does alter things. The final thing is something which we actually have some experience with, which is where the balance of storage architectures suddenly tips into yet another quasi-stable state. You know, when we suddenly get not only 5 terabyte drives, which we expect to get this coming year, but everyone really expects to make use of them now in a distributed way and in a reliable way. And, you know, erasure codes are starting to become popular, so maybe that'll work. But we don't really have a good grip on how to deal with that, either at a programming level, at a model level, or as you put it, an abstraction layer level. And certainly the average user doesn't know how to deal with this. So anyway, those are my three things, if people wanted to comment on those.
A comment on one of them. The reason that I think that the memristor technology, or in general extremely high IOP storage technology, is so critically important and disruptive is because the problem that we haven't solved, and I don't believe we will be able to solve, is resource contention issues across the bottleneck devices of disk I/O and virtualization. So the cloud sucks because of storage. The lack of reliability, it's the leading cause of misery in the cloud, because multi-tenancy, you have violent neighbors, and even if they're not intending to, it's the guy writing the dev script that parses a log file that takes your production box down that's co-located on the same box. And the high IOP technologies that are coming out that can supplant all of the spinning disks and SSDs, which are way too slow, stand to change that and kind of erase the problem, right? You don't have to solve it anymore. That problem doesn't present itself. And I think that'll radically change the ability to adopt virtualization.
And just to respond a little bit to the comment of how hard it is to program distributed systems, of course it is. And that's part of the reason that we shouldn't all do it independently. We should be working on a shared platform so that we can solve those problems correctly and iterate toward the right solution and not have everyone rolling their own, you know, distributed agreement protocol or trying to implement Paxos in some, you know, optimized way that they don't really understand and so on.
Is there any evidence that we are converging? I mean, we've been doing this for a few years, actually a couple of decades. Is there any evidence we're converging to anything?
We're not working on the same platform yet. I wouldn't expect us to all converge when we're trying to write these distributed algorithms for these special snowflake systems that everyone is trying to manage.
I think that's true from a macroscopic level, but if you look at the adoption of something like Zookeeper, which I'm not a huge fan of, but it is consistent, it's one algorithm, and it's pretty consistently used that when someone wants to go in and build a distributed system and they want to go implement Paxos, they actually do find something and go, oh, well, I have to run Java, but I will run it anyway and I'll get Zookeeper. And then I'll kind of push that problem down into another layer. So I think that that's not always the right solution, but it almost always is.
Yeah, I mean, to be clear, there are some well-written solutions for some of these problems, but they only work if you can run them. And I think increasingly we'll be running systems that have these solutions built on top of them. And it may be that the ones that have the solutions are going to be the systems that we run rather than the other way around, depending on how it plays out.
Well, as the founder of a project that was oriented around the idea of multi-tenant storage, I have to agree, yes, the cloud does suck because of storage. That's why I work on it. But there are two lessons here that I think are important to remember is, there are two anti-lessons, you might say. Every time I do hear that somebody's implementing a new agreement protocol or consistency protocol or something, my first reaction is, no, don't do that, please. And there's enough of them out there already, and half of them are already broken, and we don't need more broken ones. So yes, I mean, that's a great area for convergence. That is a sufficiently understood problem that we should be using established technology. A lot of times technology follows a curve that it's not well understood. We need to experiment. We need to compete in the market. And then we actually do figure out what some set of right solutions looks like, and we should go experiment on something else because there's always another problem. The other is that as these storage hierarchies continue to get deeper, people are going to be caching at all layers of the system. And one of my favorite things that I like to tell people who join the projects that I'm working on in storage is every time you cache, you absolutely have to think about the problem of what happens when the cache copy diverges from the original copy, or when multiple cache copies diverge from each other. Now, it's okay to say, sure, they can diverge, that's fine, our application doesn't care. But you have to think about it to come to that answer. And I have seen hundreds, thousands of bugs that resulted from people caching and not thinking about the consequences of having cached. And so that's one of the things that it's not perhaps strictly relevant to, you know, the disruptive technology idea, but I'm up on a stage, I'm going to say it. Please just don't do that.
So I just wanted to comment really quickly on Andrew's observation about hardware getting faster. It seems like hardware getting faster has changed, and I think this is something we're going to need to deal with as a community. For a long time, we could count on Moore's Law and pretty much everything else in the computing platform providing what amounts to strong scaling for workloads, right? You get a machine that's twice as fast, your workload goes twice as fast. With the amount of parallelism in our systems and the amount of parallelism in our workloads, the protocols that we have don't do so great, and the hardware that we have doesn't do so great in terms of making it easy to get lots of performance out of a single system. New systems are clearly faster than old systems, but I think that we need to start thinking about systems as being parallel in some sense.
Also have one more comment about the please God don't make us program distributed systems. I think that's largely true, and we see software engineers, at least in the world that I work in the internet-facing world, software engineers, it's not that operations people are starting to code. I mean, they are, but it's more that software engineers are starting to operate things. Right, software engineers are programming against APIs that actually affect and influence infrastructure and topology and all of those things. And what our job is now is to educate software engineers, which historically has been a problem. The two groups tend to not get along or see eye to eye. But what software engineers are missing when they start touching those abstraction layers is a sense of the operational nature of what they're doing, right? They have to think about operability of systems. And so, I mean, I've spent the last year and a half or 2 years going around to software engineering conferences, ranting at software engineers that they need to adopt a more operational mindset because they're starting to touch shit that actually matters and wakes people up at night and can scale out. I mean, we've seen people launch 10,000 nodes by accident on Amazon. It's like, oh, it's a software bug. And it's like, yeah, great, software bug. I can't pay your salary anymore because we just spent it with EC2. So this idea bringing sites down, and they used to just write software that got deployed by you. Now they're actually deploying it. And I don't think you can stop that. But what you can do is you can help them make that safer, right? And it's really a mindset. It's one of the most powerful things that everyone here has is a mindset of not fucking things up when it really matters. And software engineers tend to not do that because they have development environments, they have safety nets, and suddenly when they start programming these APIs in production, they no longer have those safety nets.
Sorry to the people still waiting to ask questions. I just want to agree wholeheartedly. Yeah, go ahead.
Ray Yip at Sony Gaikai. Just go back to your Moore's Law comment. Another way of framing disruptive, or another definition of disruptive, is basically that we can't keep going on doing the same thing that we have been doing. And so in some ways, technology enables us to keep going on doing the same thing we keep on doing. Moore's Law has enabled us to write software the same way, and it just runs faster up to a certain point. But, you know, Moore's Law is actually about transistors and not about, well, clock speed, and that gap ended up showing up in terms of parallelism. We packed more transistors on a die, but now it's in terms of different execution units, and so now we do have to do something different. What other sort of phase changes do you... Another example is, you know, RAID 5. We can't really do RAID 5 anymore because the mean time to live for a disk, you know, and the size of the disk and how long it takes to calculate parity is just too long now, so RAID 5 doesn't, you know, do the right thing anymore. What other sort of transition zones do you see of that nature, or limitations where we can't just keep extrapolating or following a trend?
Well, that is actually another trend that is really going to be interesting to see what its effects are on operations. You know, I work on a scale out file system because scale up hit a dead end in storage and just as it did in computation, and we're seeing that everything has to be distributed. So that means you have new failure modes, you have new performance warts. You have all sorts of things like that. And now it's becoming distributed even within system, even within chip. I mean, you have things like Knight's Corner or whatever it's called this week. You have, you know, GPUs, things like that, that are going to require a distributed or at least parallel mindset, even to program just a single app running on what used to be a single processor. And that's going to have all sorts of implications because of those different failure modes. It's going to have implications because it makes provisioning complex again. And the only nice thing about the world mostly converging on the x86 instruction set is that it freed us from having to worry about 18 instruction sets every time we wanted to write something. Well, now... Yeah, you know, everything became very homogeneous. In some ways, that contributed to things like AWS becoming possible. But you add GPUs and massively parallel CPUs and things like that. Well, now it just got heterogeneous again, damn it. So you're going to have to think about how to provision jobs onto the types of systems that are appropriate for them. The homogeneous cloud is not going to work. Clouds are becoming more heterogeneous in terms of compute, in terms of storage. Just think what all those new storage technologies like the memristors and so forth are going to do in terms of now how many instance types is Amazon going to have? They're going to have even more because some of them are going to have this device and some of them aren't. So that becomes a much more interesting challenge.
You know, with distributed cloud architectures... What are we doing about backups? I mean, you've got components where you've got data stored in distributed places, and they're not necessarily quiet. Well, if you're trying to keep this thing up and running all the time, you can't quiesce all of it all at once and back it up in a consistent state. And the amount of data involved is ridiculous. How do you do archival?
So I wanted to actually go back to a previous topic really quickly, and then we can talk about backups. You know, there's a bunch of cases where protocols just, or the abstractions aren't quite right. So, for example, Jeff used to work on a system that had an interesting property. A single mem copy didn't get you all of memory bandwidth, right? So this is kind of weird compared to systems that we're used to thinking about. And similarly, we're now in a regimen where 40 gigabit host NICs are starting to show up, and a single 40 gigabit TCP stream is possible with the right contortions, but not easy to get, right? And I think that these things are going to keep happening, and all of these assumptions that we have about the underlying abstractions are going to change very quickly. In terms of backups, pass.
So the consistent backup question is something where, again, I think the academic literature has studied this problem of how do you get a consistent snapshot of a quickly changing, very large system. So we kind of know how to do this from an academic perspective, and it's just kind of now getting to the point where, in a practical sense, this is something that we need to do properly, and everyone should not be rolling their own algorithms for performing consistent snapshots. But we do know how to do it. And you see this a lot, actually, where stuff that academics studied and sort of converge to, well, this is on paper the right way to be doing this, only kind of becomes in vogue when the technology catches up to the right place. And virtualization is a good example of this. I mean, it was an old technology by the time that, like, Mendel Rosenblum and VMware and all that came on the scene. It was decades old. But it was its time. And I think a lot of these distributed algorithms and protocols that people have been studying for longer than I've been alive are now going to be something that people have to start focusing on. But again, we're going to have common libraries for this, I think. Also, to respond to this question of kind of other aspects of Moore's Law, there's a quote that I'll paraphrase that I think is attributed to Margot Seltzer of Harvard, which is that anytime a technology changes by an order of magnitude, you have to rethink how you're solving the problem. And what's interesting is that pretty much every year some technology reaches that point, whether it's network speeds or hard disk transfer rates or hard disk capacity or CPU speeds or memory size or memory transfer capacity and so on. You see all these things scaling up so quickly that even if it's no longer the number of transistors, there's something that will make you have to rethink exactly how you're doing something.
On the backups topic, I think for any sufficiently large distributed system, jumping way back and talking about reinventing your own, you know, consensus protocols, I'm glad people do it, because then you have papers like Spanner come out, which I think was, there is a distributed consensus there, and it's based on something different that we decided that wasn't a good idea before, and now technology is good enough to actually make it work okay. Which is an interesting concept, right? It's imperfect, but it's imperfect with a threshold that is now tolerable and interesting. That aside, any sufficiently large distributed system, you actually don't have consistency at any given point of time, right? So the idea is that, like, trying to back up something establishing a consistency regimen for backup doesn't actually resonate with your guarantees during the running system anyway. So that problem ends up being not very difficult. So the compromises that you can make while running the distributed system relative to consistency, you can exploit during the backup process to just maintain the same consistency constraints. So we have very large multi-data center cross-client backups that have to happen. And all of that, I mean, it's completely inconsistent and correct within the architecture that they're doing, because they've established which consistency is correct.
Right. I think one of the things that's coming out a lot of quite a few of these questions is recognizing that there's been a transition in how we deal with not only the design of systems, but the way that they fail. So it used to be that we would deal with failure on a very low level. We find out after running computers for a while that memory chips fail, so we have ECC memory so that we can deal with a bit failing. Or we invented RAID because we're trying to deal with a hard disk failing. And so traditional software didn't have to deal with failures. You know, there's not much software out there that's written to deal with a memory module going bad in your computer and expecting to continue to work properly. Whereas what we have now is we've built up the complexity in the layers so high that we can't deal with failure on a low level. It's just not really possible to create a system that isn't a hugely distributed system that isn't going to have failure inside of it somewhere. And so what we've had to do is start managing failure at a high level. So we have to design systems now that can deal with not only a memory module disappearing, but an entire unit of work, an entire system going down and still continuing to run. And I think that's the transition that we're in the middle of, and we're still trying to figure out the best way to deal with those things. And right now, a lot of it is ad hoc. A lot of it is people writing custom scripts or software engineering methods for dealing with these failures. But what's going to happen is, just as we standardized on the low-level failure recovery, over time we'll start standardizing on the high-level failure recovery. And at that point, we can start writing software again at the high levels that doesn't have to worry about failure, because our layers are responsible for dealing with the failure instead of us having to do it. So in the same way that you would depend on the RAID controller to keep your data consistent, you'd start depending on your higher level abstraction for keeping your systems running and not have to worry about it.
I have a comment on that. There's a lot of irony in the in that hardware release cycles are 6 to 12 months a lot of times. So we think hardware is so slow to change and software is so agile and fast, but replacing your hardware is easy, right? So replacing your software is really hard. So the software will change and adapt, and the future is the cloud, and everything will be commodity, and we can use a common API to spin things up and shut them down. When software knows how to act in those environments, and it does not, and you have this problem that software doesn't change fast. So the software you're running today that doesn't understand how to do that will still be running in your architecture 5 years from now. Pretty much guaranteed. So this vision is a vision your children will realize, right? This is a very, very long cycle that before we converge on something that actually is pleasant, and of course they won't think it's pleasant, right?
I'm Colin Hicks from the University of Edinburgh. I'm going to start with a small grunt before my question. In my local environment APIs, I wish, but. Moving on to my actual question, there's most of the stuff we've talked about now is all disruptive technologies that are going to come through really at the server/service end that we are personally responsible for. But there are disruptive technologies that come in from the user end. The recent ones are tablets and smartphones and generally mobile devices. Anything to say about those?
I think the world is obviously going mobile and wireless. Aside from the multi-device problem with synchronization, one of the changes is that, and it's both affects operations and software engineering as well, is that the idea of building incredibly high-performance, low-latency wireless networks is not here this year, and it won't be here next year. And my guess is it really won't be ubiquitous for at least 5 years. So there's a tremendous amount of, I can't wait 5 years. I can't have pissed off users for 5 years, right? That's just not going to work. So the adoption of tablets and smartphones require an experience that is high throughput and low latency, despite the network they're working on not being that way. So there's a tremendous amount of work to do stupid optimizations, things that we would never consider, right? All that assembly programming that we did on chips is now stupid pet tricks with APIs to do 7 operations in one so that you can get one, you know, one TCP handshake and one send respond. And we see that a lot. There's just so much engineering work going into making systems highly composited and highly complex to deliver things in as few round trips as possible. So the horribly sad part about that is, because software stays with us like herpes, I guess. Is that 5 years from now, when that's no longer necessary, we will be maintaining all of these stupid pet tricks for a very, very long time. We will not be able to undo them. So we are creating a phenomenal amount of baggage that we're going to take forward to us into a new, beautiful world.
You've really opened a can of worms on that one, because if your worry list wasn't long enough, let's add a couple more. We've had a couple of talks here about power-aware computing, which is going to be a major issue with mobile devices. We've had a couple about the security implications of all this wireless communication that's going on. I'm just going to toss in one more, which is the problem of spectrum pollution. We already see this when everybody fires up their portable Wi-Fi hotspot in the same airport gate. Suddenly everybody's throughput goes to crap because they're all stepping all over each other. And this is going to become more and more of a problem as we have more and more devices, and as one of our keynotes even mentioned, you know, this is just going to be exponential. We're going to have tons and tons of more devices that we have to manage. Every combination of devices is a potential for conflict between them. So there's this vastly more worrisome potential for all of these devices to interfere with each other. It's multi-tenancy on an infinite scale. So that's going to be just really, interesting.
So I'll see Jeff's, you know, horror story and add one more. It's pretty clear that we're seeing a proliferation of devices, right? Everybody in this room probably has, you know, two or three devices, except for Corey. And the thing is that we all sort of expect that to keep happening, and we know that there are people that are working on hardware infrastructure to support small microcontrollers and processors that all consume almost no energy. So you can start sprinkling these all over the place. The other end of the spectrum is also really interesting. So sensor technology is getting a lot better. So gene sequencers have been on this exponential trend for the last 5 years, and it looks like it's continuing. They're seeing between a 5x and 10x annual growth in data per dollar. So if you spend a dollar on sequencing this year, you'll get 5 to 10 times more data next year for the same cost. And the same thing is happening in all sorts of other sensors. And so there's a lot of work in the scientific community to start basically sprinkling sensors everywhere they possibly can. And so there's a last mile problem there. There's a data volume problem there. And the thing is that fundamentally the kinds of problems that these folks are tackling are systems that are complicated with emergent behavior. And there is no better exploit to try to study them than to get more data. And so I think that we're going to see an increasing trend towards sort of the data science approach to tackling problems. And that's a different skill set, right? One of the things that I think is unfortunately the case is that there aren't enough people around here that have a good handle on statistics, right? And when you're dealing with large quantities of data, that's really the big approach that you need to take.
So are you saying that 97% of the people here don't understand statistics well enough?
Plus or minus two.
I'm saying that's a different industry.
I think that's a new occupation. So if you want a career change, data science. I absolutely agree that big data, that I don't know, we're going to call it huger data or something like that, but the big data that I see today, where it's like, oh, I got to pay to buy the data. It's like, that's big. That was, if it was big today, what was it 5 years ago when they had it, you know? But I think when you start to try to compress all of the sensor data, you're actually compressing big data from a time series into a flat space, which is an information problem.
I mean, I think when people talk about big data, they're talking about both actually how much data we have and also the techniques that people are developing for analyzing it. A lot of machine learning algorithms are notorious for not scaling well, either in the number of features or in the amount of data. And so I think a lot of the things that you're seeing now for people who work on big data are just trying to see what sort of questions are we actually able to answer when we have orders of magnitude more data than I can run, you know, k-means on or something.
So just to disagree with you a little bit, I think that we may have a class of problems as operations people that can only be characterized by large quantities of data before too long, right? And that's the angle from which I think we're going to need to, at a minimum, find domain experts in data science and machine learning to work with, but at some point, you know, you need to have people that can actually speak the language.
Sorry. Matthew Barr from Snap Interactive. But we're actually seeing, as we look to building out a colo facility and then also looking towards cloud, that some of the biggest problems we have are not on the web server side and things on those lines, and even the application server, but it's really the databases that haven't really quite baked yet into where to go for high IOPS. They're requiring, you know, MySQL does not scale into the cloud very well. There are others, but there's still big discussion and still a lot of room to grow in those areas. Where do you guys see things going on in that side of the world? The OLTP type systems and parallelizing and moving forward in the future.
So there's a cool project in the AMP lab called BlinkDB, and the idea there is that there may be queries that you want to ask on extremely large data sets where you don't necessarily have time to compute over the entire data set, but you have some sense of how accurately you need to know the answer. So you can say something like, I would like to know the answer to this query, and you have 5 seconds to give me the best answer that you can compute. And it will come back, it will tell you the answer, and it will give you error bounds, saying with, you know, 95% confidence, your answer lies somewhere in this range, and so on. So I think one of the ways that you can get around dealing with such huge quantities of data is not actually deal with huge quantities of data. But of course, in order to do this sort of thing, you need to have an understanding of statistics. And I guess, you know, one perspective is that there will certainly be people who specialize in that sort of thing, and I think that's true. I also think that you can have a tremendous advantage if you have at least a rudimentary understanding of some of these statistical questions, because you'll be able to attack these problems on your own without having to call in an expert.
I think a lot of the answers we'll be getting back from various tools will have statistical error margins around them, and you, a basic understanding of what that actually means and how much you can trust the answers you get is pretty important. From the database perspective, MySQL can scale. It's incredibly painful. It requires sacrifices. But what I think it is, I mean, so people hate databases in general because they're abused by them. And there's this whole NoSQL movement, which actually removes the one good thing about databases, which was SQL, which is that it was a common language, right? It's the abstraction layer that allowed people to to go from one technology to another. It prevented vendor lock-in. There's all these different things. You could switch from one technology to another because what was under the abstraction wasn't good for you without losing your abstraction layer. So where is this going? There are databases that scale much better that do not have the same semantics or accessibility that SQL databases do. I'm not saying it will go to SQL. Ideally, I think that 10 years from now, I'll run SQL and I won't care that it's distributed behind it. It may not be SQL, but in the future, there will be an abstraction layer that's consistent across technologies that are distributed with eventual consistency models and that.
I mean, there's also the whole NewSQL movement as well. In addition to, as a response to the NoSQL, there's the NewSQL stuff. I know there was a paper last year, I think, on Volt and a couple others, but I wasn't sure if anyone else had seen the industry somewhat shaking out on the NewSQL side yet. And it hasn't happened.
It will get there. NewSQL is not it. So, it's part of it. I mean, it's going to be part of the DNA.
Right.
So, it's just that when somebody comes out and says this is the answer, that's not the answer.
Yeah.
And that is actually going to be an interesting convergence between a couple of themes that we've touched on, is that a lot of the new SQL databases, if you look at how they're actually producing their awesome performance numbers, it's because they're only running in memory, which is just really not quite what you want in a lot of cases. Now, that's sort of that tipping point phenomenon, that when we get these memory-like technologies, that might actually be the right kind of technology to run on top of them. I don't think it's the right kind of technology to run on top of memory because of, you know, memory not being permanent. It's, you know, clearly some of the technologies that we've developed for permanent media, such as spinning disks, are kind of not applicable. So I think we're going to see more and more new architectures around this particular in-between set of characteristics. And probably some of those ideas are going to come from the traditional database world. Some of them are going to come from the NoSQL world. Some of them are kind of going to come from the NewSQL world. But I don't think until we all get our hands on those devices that we're going to see what the set of right answers is for how to design databases to work optimally with those.
It's also just to add on to that, as these new technologies come in. There was a lot of effort put on the computing side, and now there's a whole bunch of effort going into improving storage and network bandwidth. But I think the one constant that we're running into, at least in the short term, is going to be latency. So that's what stops us from building a giant distributed computer. We're going to have great bandwidth. We're going to be able to have fast access to storage, but we're still going to have to be bound by the speed of light as we transfer data across systems. And so it's just that the bottleneck moves around. We had computing bottleneck, now we have a storage bottleneck, and then we're getting into a bandwidth bottleneck, and pretty soon we're going to have a latency bottleneck. And so that's going to bring a whole new set of problems or things that we're going to need solutions for.
I think the
the upside of the latency bottleneck, I'll predict one thing. That's not getting fixed. Right. I mean, so that will require that will require a redefinition of certain physics that we understand, which will happen, but 10-year prediction going to happen. So latency we're going to be stuck with. So I think that there's going to be some really creative ways to move computation towards data. And when this stuff happens, every time data changes, the way you move it toward and when that pays off, the whole cost benefit model of that starts to shift, and we all have to reevaluate our life decisions at that point. And
the idea of moving computation towards data is actually going to be increasingly systems that don't do that are just going to be outdated. Hadoop has, for whatever else it's done, has proven the value of doing that. Any storage system that doesn't help to do that, that doesn't provide the location information that it needs to do that, is going to lose pretty badly. I mean, I know Gluster does that. I know Ceph does that. I know others do that. It's like one of the main things that is new about just about every distributed storage system I've been seeing is that they're all starting to do this mostly in the last year or so. And I think that's something you need to look for as you're architecting, is how do you do that?
Christopher DeMarco, Maya Design. You already talked a little bit about proliferation of wireless networking. If Intel's radio, free Intel, Moore's Law radio, if that stuff, radio, digital radios on chips, if that comes to fruition and all of the microchips that we put everywhere right now suddenly have radios in them and can talk to each other and can talk to us. You talked a little bit about the difficulties that will cause in the mobile space. Can you talk a little bit about what that will mean when those are not necessarily mobile endpoint devices, but, light bulbs and shower heads and tags in your shirt? Can you talk a little bit about the implications of vastly proliferated wireless networking?
The implications to what? I guess that's a really broad question.
A really broad question.
Okay, cool. I think this is another source of data that we're going to have. And once you can measure something, you can start to answer questions about it. So as the number of things that we're able to measure on a large scale increase, the space of possible things that we can do, I think, explodes. It's really exciting.
I think from the electrical engineering point of view, there's some challenges. You have spectrum issues, right? So I think that when the density of devices becomes absurd, we're going to have to start looking at, I don't know what the right solution to that is, but the all the approaches for ad hoc wireless mesh networking seem to apply pretty well to that. So I'm sure there's going to be a pretty active field of research on when I have 15,000 devices in the first floor of my house. They're probably not going to they're not going to all be 100 meter radio signals, because that would probably be a bad idea. So how do they talk to each other? Where do they go? How do they route? And that's going to all have to be baked in way down on the transport layer, so that everything works well, which is going to be awesome for denial of service attacks and exploits and awesome. That's going to be a lot of money in that industry.
Yeah, and there's definitely a lot of horrible security implications to that. I think also one thing that might come out of this is one solution people are going to start looking at is line of sight and optical technologies, which sort of avoid the everybody sharing the same frequency in the same space problem. And that's true in the mobile space. There have been a couple of companies that I've noticed who've tried to do something like that, in the data center space or even in the intra-cabinet space. I don't know if any of them have met any success, because as we've mentioned, some technologies come along before the enabling technology to make them useful and relevant comes along. And then when something else happens somewhere else in technology, we have to brush them off and say, oh, now we have a spectrum problem. Now we need these technologies that avoid the spectrum problem by not sharing the same space. Unfortunately, the companies that probably invented a lot of it will have sunk by then. But hopefully there will be a new crop of companies that will brush off that technology and use it to help us solve that problem.
I personally fear the maker movement on that, with all of these small spinning dental mirrors and the Lego Mindstorms to line up. That's my fear, because I'm going to have to read about it a lot.
This also might be the impetus to deploy IPv6. So if there aren't any more questions from the audience, I want to end the discussion with maybe not quite so much prognostications, but things that you're excited about. What are the new pieces of technology that people should be paying attention to that they're probably not looking at? I'll start off with OpenFlow. This is probably going to change the way that networks work over the next couple of years.
So I'm going to make one more comment, and then I'll give my final thought. So Theo mentioned earlier that there's this tension between software engineers and system administrators. And I think a lot of that comes from the fact that software engineers are used to having this abstraction layer beneath them that, of course, in addition to providing services, kind of prevents them from doing harm in certain ways. And what Theo was mentioning was that now that abstraction layer, once they're starting to spin up EC2 instances and other such things, there's no longer that barrier that's preventing them from potentially doing bad stuff. And so I think in addition to educating them, there's a responsibility from this audience to help develop that API that they're going to have to be programming to and that you are going to have to program to. So it's not just about this API will exist and you're going to have to build stuff on top of it and share it with each other. It's also that you're going to have to help define what that layer is and use all of the knowledge that you built up over decades of how exactly do you think about this system. And if you were going to give someone else an API so that they could write code that's going to migrate instances or take checkpoints and so on, what would that API look like? And as far as what I'm excited about in terms of technology, I'm actually excited about the fact that we're constrained in terms of certain resources like energy, especially on mobile devices. There's been a trend since the beginning of computing that we have these technologies that are becoming more and more cheap. And so people can build layers and layers and layers of abstraction that basically mean that you're spending 10,000 times as much time and resources solving a problem that if you started from just the bare metal and said, what is the most efficient way for me to do this computation, that you would end up with a much more elegant, much simpler solution that didn't require all of these resources. And so the fact that we're starting to become constrained in certain ways, and energy is the one that pops to mind, especially on mobile devices, I think that's great. I think people are going to start to think about optimization earlier than they do now, and that's a good thing. There was a cool keynote talk at Middleware just last week that Jim Laris gave, and he was showing all sorts of interesting graphs and statistics about the explosion of the amount of resources people are spending. There was a student, he gave a chart that some student at MIT had made about the resources required to do a matrix multiplication. And so it went all the way from, on the one end, high-level language, I think Python may have been the one on one side, and then all the way down to BLAST, you know, where it's going to actually run a bunch of different parameter space optimizations for your particular device and then do the most efficient matrix multiplication. And it was something like 7 orders of magnitude in terms of the amount of time that it took from BLAST all the way up to a higher level language. And that's an incredible amount of space that is remaining for doing optimizations and so on. So as great as it is to have new abstraction layers, and that's going to happen, I'm also excited about the fact that some of those abstraction layers are going to go away.
I'm tired. I don't know if I'm excited about that much. I've been, you know, abused by technology every day. It's hard to remain excited. I would say that not so much of a technology that excites me, but a general mode of operation that I see in systems administrators and operations engineers is this idea of a full recreation from bare metal being a primary goal. From people. I mean, I remember 15 years ago when a server crashed, you spent all day rebuilding it. I mean, that's just how it worked. You restored it, you had to find things off backup. And the one thing that the horribly inconsistent cloud gave us is absolutely no assurances that we wouldn't be doing that every hour. So we've kind of changed our mentality and decided that it's a really good thing to absolutely and completely automate the deployment of what we're doing. And I think we decided that a long time ago, you know, talking and doing are different, but what I see is people actually doing that. So the idea of being able to spin up their architectures, their infrastructures, completely from scratch in an automated and repeatable way, that's pretty exciting. And I don't actually care what technology they're using. It's the mentality that I think is exciting.
I'm going to go with two things. One completely non-computer related, and that is electric cars. Pretty excited about those. I think 10, 15 years from now, we may not have many combustion engines on the road. It'd be kind of cool. That may be too fast. Technology-wise, I'm really excited about the way that the unit of work is expanding. So what I mean by that is being able to think of a system as built of a bunch of other systems as opposed to built of a bunch of individual components like storage, hardware, processor, and memory, but being able to say, hey, this whole system is something that I can talk to directly. It's something that as humans, I feel like we're much better equipped to deal with than we are with abstract concepts. It makes more sense to us to be able to plug in a router and just have that router work rather than having to understand how to construct a router in software. And the same way with systems, the more that we have to understand about the inner workings of the system, admittedly, there are times when you do have to be able to dive in and, you know, just like today, occasionally you have to fire up GDB and debug some assembly code, but it doesn't happen as much as it used to. Right now, today, you still have to dive in and understand why your Juju install of Hadoop is no longer working, but hopefully less and less in the future. So I'm excited about our understanding being able to move up into larger and larger components so that we can use those and figure out interesting things to do by plugging those components together instead of having to worry about all of the lower level pieces. Without that higher level concept, we don't have the ability to think of and solve larger problems. You couldn't write the software that exists today if you were still dealing with assembly language instructions because it's just too hard to think that high up the stack when you're having to deal with stuff that's so far down.
Well, the challenge of going last is that I feel like I have this pressure to be even more grandiose than the other fellows. So the concept I'm going to go with is asynchrony, that for a long, long time we've all gotten used to thinking of things in terms of being in the same place at the same time, things happening in the same order. And this goes all up and down the scale, that this is not holding anymore. We have asynchronous programming models. We have asynchronous distributed systems. We have asynchronous human systems. You know, a lot of people here probably work in teams that are distributed all over the world and now communicate asynchronously more than face-to-face in real time. Our purchasing habits are no longer synchronous. You know, I've been doing Christmas shopping online for pretty obvious reasons. That's not synchronous either. I'm not going into a store and being with somebody even virtually at the same time. I'm placing my order and asynchronously it's getting shipped. And we all need to think about this idea that things aren't together. They aren't together in space. They aren't together in time. And all of our workflows from instructions all the way up to how we run our lives are going to be increasingly asynchronous in their nature. And that's really going to disrupt just about everything.
Let's thank our panelists for a bunch of very interesting ideas.